Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Welcome to The Last Round MMA. And today's special guest is Ian Uncle Creepy McCall. Thanks for joining me, Ian.
Thank you for having me. Very good to be here.
So this is going to be a good one. I think out of all of the ones I've done so far, I think I have the most notes on you. So this is could be a long episode. Could be a long episode.
Let's do it. It's fine. My day, I finished a really busy morning with clients and a different podcast. We're moving buildings in our gym, Peace Warrior. Just a lot of stuff going on. But right now, after this, I can just relax and smoke a joint and chill for the rest of the day until I teach.
Okay, so let's jump straight into it. So, Ian, where did you grow up and how did you get started in combat sports?
I grew up in Orange County, here in Dana Point, Laguna Beach area. You usually don't think of wealthy areas producing top flight fighters. But Orange County has, even the poor people have more money than rich people other places. I myself come from the 1%. My family's, you know, loaded, generational sort of stuff. My grandfather was the president of the United States a long time ago. He was the guy, Franklin Pierce was his name. And he started the Civil War for slavery. So it's my grandpa. I like to say I'm learning disabled. I'm not good in school. I never was. I would have been labeled autistic or something like that if I wasn't so good at sports. My parents didn't have so much money, and if my parents would have taken me to a psychologist or something, but they wouldn't do that. They knew that was poison. They saw my propensity for violence. I got kicked out of, you know, four of the nicest private schools here for beating people up. I was always getting in fights. By the time I was 15, I started training martial arts when I was four. I started training jiu-jitsu, and that was kung fu. I started training jiu-jitsu and wrestling at my high school and jiu-jitsu in my off time when I was 14. I was able to beat up grown men by the time I was 15. I started striking. I was, you know, back then, this was over 23 years ago, a long time ago. People had no idea how to fight back then. And, you know, the fact that I sucked at the beat, I sucked surfing, but I'm friends with some of the best surfers in the world. You know, surfing is a fighting culture. It's very, very, okay, let's take it in and get in a fight. And I was always like, I'll just sit here. I'll just hang out and wait till fights come. And, you know, I wasn't really the one like picking a lot of fights, but I beat up a lot of frat guys or a lot of poor tourists that were, you know, just trying to protect their girlfriends from like getting water balloons thrown at them. You know, we were little douchebags. And, you know, it was just a weird part of the culture. Back then, you could still fight like that. And I really quickly joined the wrong group of kids. We were in a gang. Fighting everybody, and we had a name. We ended up on the news. I was headed down a bad path. You know, I was on felony probation by the time I was 15, gang terms probation, and it wasn't like a gang, like we were gang banging in the hood. We were a bunch of really tough kids who trained, and we had a name for ourselves, and we'd love to beat people up. We didn't really do them. I was probably one of only two people selling drugs. Because I knew no one's gonna take drugs from me. I'm one of the most dangerous people here, my brother and I. So it was like this weird, you know, all the rich kids are running around to buy drugs somewhere kind of thing. So, you know, I had a really healthy childhood. No one ever touched me. You know, I've now that I work in healing, I had to figure out where I went wrong. You know, my mom left when I was 12, but my dad worked a lot. Like a lot. And he was heartbroken and so on. So he was always, we had a penthouse in downtown LA. He was always there. I had the beach house to myself and parties. And, you know, it was just, I was falling into the wrong side of life. I was addicted by the time I was 14 to painkillers. And fighting is what saved my life. You know, I mean, I got arrested by the DEA when I was in the UFC. Mm. Like, I went to jail while I was in the UFC because they got a bad, I was making money and I wasn't selling drugs at the time, but it was too late, but they still had a reason to take me in because I was on probation. So this is something that plagued my whole life, this, like, you know, addiction and these sort of things. I saw the light in it because I was like, this is a job. I can barely read and write at the time, you know, at least not very well. So I saw it as my outlet. It was my saving grace. I was very good at it. I went pro at 18 and fought very rarely in between there because it was once a year, basically, because it was such a fringe sport. And number one, people didn't want to fight me. Number two, if they did, it was over quickly. So I didn't even learn that much. And it was just wasn't happening a lot. There's no money in it. So, you know, I can continue to fund myself with, you know, things like cannabis, you know, sales, and had a really weird path to being the fighter. You know, I decided, but I was manicured. My parents spoiled me and got me the best coaches and the best strength conditioning people and the best diets and the best everything. So I had a pretty easy path, I'm not gonna lie. They knew I had some sort of genetic lottery where I was stronger and faster and meaner than people. I had a lot of the attributes you look for in an athlete, in that sort of athlete. So, you know, I got my whole life kind of everything, these little boundaries set in place, these good people around me, whether it was my wrestling coach in high school or my, you know, Colin Oyama in fighting or whoever it was, Jiva Santana, I had really good coaches. And they steered me in the right direction, you know. I did go to college once. I went to college to go wrestle and I blew my knee out and I was failing anyway, so I would have dropped out. But I ended up living on I had my own house, but I was living on Chuck Liddell's couch. And I remember Antonio Banuelos was world champion then in WBC. There's the last champion before Zuffa bought it. And, you know, I was a 19-year-old kid who showed up. I knew Antonio and Jake Shields and them since I was 15, but when I came in and put on my little, you know, sparring performances for the guys like Chuck and John Hackelman and Glover Teixeira and all these people, they were like, oh shit, you can submit the champ. You can, you know, get sometimes the best of them on the feet and you're wrestling. And he was a nationally wrestler. Like, this is all crazy. Like, you're going to be the next world champion. So, you know, we won't get into how that boosted my ego. We'll get into just how it guided me in life. Having Chuck Liddell as a mentor and a brother figure, you know, in my life was very beneficial. And I was just kind of guided through these wins and was, you know, undefeated. And then my first bout with loss was in WBC. And the wins, whatever. I mean, my first fight on TV was with Cody Wheeler and I hurt him. They said he was going to beat me because he had a better record by like one fight. I almost killed that kid. And right after, what did I do? I went right back to partying because I would have a training camp and I would get sober. I went right back into partying and Scott Adams called me and he's like, hey man, you know, I knew him from San Luis Obispo. I thought we were friends. And he's like, yeah, you know, you're going to fight next weekend. We need someone to step in. And I was like, bro, I'm at a birthday party. I'm fucked up right now. I'm high on this. I'm high on that. I'm hammered. Oh, I'm like, sure. No, I'm not fighting, man. I'll talk to you Monday. And he's like, yeah, we'll talk Monday. Get ready. You know? And I Monday came and he's like, your flights are like, you're coming. And I was like, no. So, you know, having to deal with that, the shit show of my life, all of a sudden I go see Charlie Valencia across the cage from me. And everyone knew I could beat Charlie's ass, but Charlie's a very dangerous individual still. And he caught me slipping. You know, he did. And that threw me off for a while. And then I got back on course and I, you know, had a few fights, fought Dominic Cruz with a broken leg, put on a shitty performance there and was just trying to figure this out. I was like, maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I need to, you know, figure this out. And I took some little bit of time off. And my life you know, very addicted, trying to get my shit together. But ended up, you know, going to rehab twice, overdosing, dying, all that sort of stuff. And I came out by the time, you know, I'm mid 20s, and man, yeah, it was a while ago. I was sober. I had nothing else to do, you know, but people knew knew how talented I was. And because I was in rehab and didn't have anything else to do, I was getting really, I was in the gym all the time. When I was the main part of rehab, I got kind of fat and just gross and just out of shape and not doing it. And I, you know, ended up getting back in the gym full time, really hard, really hard. And I was beating up people in the gym. I won't say any names, but, you know, there'd be seminars or whoever, these really good people would show up that I knew from WBC, and I would handle them. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe I should. And my coach goes, hey, you need money, right? I was like, mm-hmm, I do. Again, no life skills outside of violence. So I didn't have a job. I was just trying to figure my life out. And I knew the guy I was fighting. I was like, okay, this would be an easy paycheck. Went out there, won. Made the Uncle Creepy name as a joke because, you know, being sober, I was the sober driver for all my friends. And we got home from the bars one night. My friend's son was awake, and it was trying to put him to bed. He said, Uncle Ian, Uncle Ian, Uncle Ian. And then he goes, Uncle Creepy. And everybody heard. And we were in Chuck's living room. Everyone sat up and they were like, that's your nickname. It's your nickname. I never thought I was going to fight again. It was a joke. I used to make fun of Chuck. I'm like, oh, you're the Iceman. You know, you're fucking Huntington Beach bad boy. Like, come on, you douchebag. It's silly. And I like to make fun of my friends. So, of course, that stuck. I wrote it down as a joke. And I won very impressive fashion. My friends love the name. So after that fight, I got sober. You know, I was sober. I won that fight. I looked incredible. I went and got a tattoo on my chest. Well, I used that as an excuse to get high. Just the one time. And I overdosed. I died, ended up in the hospital. And I remember waking up. It was my dad, my brother, and this girl I was dating at the time. And, you know, my dad was like, are you done? This is over? I'm like, yeah, I am good. I'm done. I'm sorry. So go out of that. I'm sitting in the hospital. This is a big part of it. By myself, outside of my family, a few people. I didn't want anyone. I didn't even want them there. I was so upset with myself. My agent calls me, Jason House, and he goes, hey, man, where you been? I was like, oh, I'm in the hospital. What? You know, what the fuck? And I told him what happened. And like, he's like, oh, you want me to come? And I'm like, no, don't come. I don't want to see anybody. I'm busy doing push-ups and sit-ups and just healing by myself. I was very depressed. More angry than depressed, you know? Well, he called me for a reason, is that they wanted me to fight Formiga, Josie Formiga, in a few months in WEC or in Attachi Palace. Mm. Yeah, they know your name. They want to make a name off you. This kid's supposed to be the best 125er in the world. We think you got a shot. So I signed it while I was in a hospital bed, and I just aspirated. I died apparently twice. You know, when I left the hospital, the doctor was like, wait, what? You have what? I'm like, oh, I have a fight coming up. He's like, sure you do. He's like, he took my vitals and, you know, figured out, you know, my body, and was like, I've never seen someone like, I just brought you back to life a week ago. Now you're in better shape than anyone I've ever seen in my life in person. My resting heart rate is like 35. I won the genetic lottery, very much so. My body was built to do sports and, you know, this sort of thing. And I built it on top of that. But so I signed to fight him, went out there, beat him, cemented my name as, you know, what it properly should have been, was like, oh shit, Ian's one of the best in the world. Ian's one of the pound for pound best fighters on the planet. And he just proved it. So Sean Shelby hits me up on Twitter. What's your phone number? And I was like, yes, phone number. Perfect. Okay. He hits me up. We want to make a division for you. We, you know, if you keep putting on performances like you're doing, we're going to make you a division. and want to do a tournament style. Then I ran through Dustin Ortiz. I beat Dustin Ortiz's ass. I did. I fucking dropped him. I kicked him in the head. I did beat him up, but that was a really hard fight. That guy's really hard to fight. I don't want to disparage him or disrespect him at all. He's a badass. And I remember the first thing I did, whop, kicked him in the head. And he went like fucking a zombie. I was like, uh-oh. I dropped him and he was up against the cage and I was hitting him square in the face, like the side of the face. And he would just go, bang, I'm okay. Bang, I'm okay. I was like, oh, dude, stop. Go to bed. I'm going to kill you. I will try and kill you if you let me. And then it was Daryl Montague. Daryl Montague knew he was beat from the day it got announced. Because you know, everyone had already said, oh, Ian's the best in the world. But Daryl's like, I'm the champ. Like, what? And I was like, I'm still better than you. He knew that. We all knew it. So that fight was won pretty easily. I'm not going to lie. It was over before it started. Got the belt. UFC made the division. And, you know, the first fight with Demetrius. I got put at, like, superstar status at that point. I mean, really famous at one point. It was kind of crazy for a couple of years. To the point where now, I mean, I still get a lot of love and free stuff and adoration. And, you know, just the, when people talk to me about, like, especially fighting, like, man, like, you know, you were one of the best ever. I'm like, I know, but I didn't prove it. Whatever shit happens. My Al Bundy moment, you know, 3 touchdowns one night. I went out there and I should have beat Demetrius. And yes, that moment where I got screwed out of the whatever, the people counted wrong. I always try and use myself as an example, a learning experience. A lot of people win cool stuff, okay, but they don't ever talk about the loss. And I use that loss to start using again. I literally went upstairs to my room in Australia and I started using OxyContin again with my ex-wife. DJ used that as an opportunity to become DJ. Like, he became arguably the best fighter of all time. You know, would have I been able to do that with probably 10 times the money he made, 10 times the fame? Probably not. I'd probably be dead. I was a psycho. I was trying to kill someone on TV because I knew I could get away with it because it's a sport. I knew I had to have that extra thing, you know, that extra meanness when it came to the sport, because I knew I was physically gifted, or just as gifted or more than these other people, technically gifted, but also that mean factor was a part of it. You know, I really got off on violence in a very strange way. I don't want to call it sexual because that's a little not into that, but it was definitely physical. You know, it was a physical addiction. And I was addicted to a lot of stuff, women, drugs, risking my life, fighting, these things that gave me these crazy highs and crazy lows. And that kind of plagued my whole career, you know, wins, losses. I'd get sober. I would beat Brad Pickett up, or I would be in Brazil and I'd win. But I had injuries. Like, this is my good finger, you know, like, that's at my hand. It used to be stuck like this. When I fought Brad Pickett, it was like this and it was infected. I hope I didn't give him any infection. But, you know, I got to Ireland and the guy from the UFC pulls me aside. He goes, let me see your hand. I showed it to him. He goes, holy shit, mate, what are we going to do? And I was like, oh, holy shit, mate, you're going to get this thing trained and I'm going to beat the shit out of Brad with it. That's what I'm going to do. That's exactly what I did. You know, I didn't take medication, but I was sick. But I didn't really feel it that much, honestly. Just my hand was hot and infected. The rest of me was fine. But I didn't take the antibiotics. I knew that would screw me up. And then, you know, fought John Lineker, froze. I should have beat John. Should have won. Should have beat a lot of people, you know. And just then I started to get sick. And me getting sick was stress on my body from, you know, making weight and having fights fall through, and one after another after another. And on top of that, I was highly addicted to OxyContin and muscle relaxers, and, you know, sometimes fentanyl or heroin. You know, outside of the addictions like women and stuff, the things that were really plaguing my life were the drugs. you know, they had the USADA test. I wish I could find my USADA test and see what was in there. It was always cocaine, always ecstasy, ketamine, just, you know, tons of opiates and stuff. So, you know, that I never got an opportunity really to really shine because I had tons of injuries as well. I had 7 surgeries on this arm, 3 here, 2 breaks, 2 infections, fracture, dislocation, and 4 surgeries here on this shoulder. And then I tore my hip and my groin real bad, popped my knee. Like, I had lots of injuries in the UFC. So it was a multitude of things, you know. It was just, yeah, I never really got the chance to show my true potential. That's why I use my career as a learning experience, because, you know, I'm not the only guy out there like this. There's a bunch of guys that could, girls that could have been one of the best ever, but they couldn't get their shit together. You know, that's why I do what I do with psychedelics. Psychedelics is just a tool. It's a keyword right now, you know, hot button topic. And I'm one of the first people to do it. I think I'm one of the first 2 coaches that work with athletes specifically, myself and my good buddy, Adam Bramlage. You know, and he does more microdose. So, I mean, he educates more on the microdosing side. And because he works with Dr. James Fadiman, who's the godfather of microdosing. So yeah, that's the mission now. You know, like I ended up going to Japan and having no success. I shouldn't say horrible success. I had a negative experience in the fights, but I had a really good time in Japan because they treated me great. And I love the culture. I'm covered in Japanese tattoos and, you know, Japanese philosophy. My dad handed me the Book of 5 Rings when I was a kid. We used to own part of Toyota, to a big dealership in downtown LA. And I've just always been, you know, obsessed with Japanese culture through my family even. And when I got out there, it is such a magical place. I really need to go back to Japan. But the first fight, you know, Manel Cape, everything was built up to be really cool. But then my head hit the rope and sliced my head. You can still see this thing from right here. It goes from there to there. They don't let you wear Vaseline. You can't put Vaseline on your face in Japan because Sakuraba got greased and got the shit beat out of him really bad. So they changed that rule where no one can grease. The ropes in Japan, at least at this point, were they were plastic LED piping. Because if you've ever seen LEDs on the bulb, they really look like razor wire. So they put this clear piping out on the outside that was like PVC, so the ropes would light up. And really hard, like PVC hard. So my dry skin and that dry thing, it cut me down to the skull. And, you know, Manel tried to get me in a guillotine and I was fighting out of it. And I remember looking at Jason Herzog and he goes, "You good?" I'm like, "I'm good. I'm good." And I looked at him right when I looked, all the blood went right into my eyes. And I was like, "Oh shit." And I know the rules in Japan. They don't like blood, number one. And I was like, "Oh man, I can't see anything. I'm like, there's so much blood in my eyes." He goes, "All right," breaks the fight up. They look at my face and they're like, "Nope." So that pissed me off. That sucked. That hurt because I knew I could beat Manel at the time. And I wanted to tap dance on his face. Such an obnoxious kid at the time. He seems to have gotten better, but he just said a lot of really inappropriate shit to people. That's why I slapped him, because he just does inappropriate things. And I wanted to hurt him. That would have been a good time. Then when I went to go fight Horiguchi, both these fights, I was snorting Oxycontin in the bathroom before. You know, I was high the whole time I was in Japan. I was maintaining. I was trying not to get high. I was just trying not to detox, because when I detoxed, and I don't know if you remember in UFC, I ended up in the hospital a couple times. I ended up at the hospital in Ireland. I ended up in the hospital in New York. I ended up in the hospital in Brazil. I was detoxing off drugs. And it didn't make life easy. I wasn't, maybe I got sick, but I don't think, I'm pretty sure it was just all detox. Because I was doing heroin and Oxycontin, you know, like, what do you expect? It wasn't like I was taking a couple of Norcos here and there to kill the pain like I used to do. It was full on gnarly addiction. So you know, this time I could be high on OxyContin and I could go fight. And I was like, well, it makes it, that, and Japan pays in cash. You know, I wasn't thinking properly. So it all, you know, it all made sense until, you know, I'm knocked unconscious or my head is split open. It just didn't go well. So finally I walked in the back, looked at my coaches and I was like, it's over, right? Because I'd never been knocked out before. And they just nodded their heads and we went and got a beer. So that was it. You know, it was 16 years of a lot of fights and a lot of fun, a lot of world traveling. There's stories in there for days. That was a very abridged version. There's story upon story upon story of just a good time. You know, I finally made peace with the sport and my career. I took some years off because I was just angry. I was just upset. I didn't forgive myself for what I did to the sport or what I, you know, I was a monster. I was crazy. And I ended up hating the sport. just hating it because of who I became to be there, you know, a long way. And actually I was in the jungles doing ayahuasca and had a whole night of coming back to martial arts and forgiving myself and, you know, a few other things happened in the trip. I mean, that was a big part of it was I need to get back into martial arts and teaching and kung fu and not just jujitsu and stuff. You know, so I'm finally happy with it. I can go to a fight and not have like a really visceral response to, because I used to just get so worked up, you know, being there. And now I can't have that same response when I'm coaching athletes and I see athletes do good or bad. I can celebrate, you know, but when you see the people you love rendered unconscious or broken limbs, it doesn't feel good. So for me to be able to manage that PTSD that I'll get from seeing that, well, it's an easier process, you know, not having to freak out over everything. Makes my life easier.
So Ian, how did you get first started on like the OxyContin and the recreational drugs? Were you overcoming an injury or?
So I started smoking pot when I was 8. My dad smuggled cannabis around the world in the 70s. And he didn't know I was stealing it, but I was stealing his weed. I started, you know, taking psychedelics when I was 12. I took acid for the first time. I got into recreational like prescription drugs when I was 14 and then was smuggling them across the border from Mexico for a good maybe 5 years. And was obviously taking them a bunch, you know, it screwed up my own entire high school career for wrestling. So yeah, it was 14 on and I had injuries. I had tons of injuries. So I could get prescriptions from doctors and then have my prescription bottle or bottles and then get some big 500 tin of, you know, pills and fill it up and have it with me. So I just always had pills, you know, and they worked to some degree, but not really, you know, they really stop having a real, real effect after like 2 weeks. I mean, part of it helps, you feel better, but yeah, it's not a healthy way to live.
So how did you find out that your father was smuggling cannabis? Because I'm sure he probably didn't just, you know, hey, son, I'm a cannabis dealer. You know, I'm sure it's something he tried to hide. So, you know, is there a story about how you found out?
So, and he, I mean, this was something he did for fun. He did it to see the world. He didn't do it for money. You know, he comes from, you know, a great family. His brother died and he took off, his best friend. You know, his brother died when he was 16 and his brother was, my uncle Brad was 18, a car accident. And he was already the black sheep. He was already, you know, he's a surfer and waterman, and surfing and dope smuggling go hand in hand, that whole culture. So at this point, you know, he's running the giant family corporation and business. You know, we have a beach house. Like, my dad, you know, was not that guy anymore. But when I came home from private school, I saw my brother, and your brother and your dad are like, for me at least, were the two coolest people in my life at that point. And I see my brother and I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, I'm smoking. Smoking what? It's weed. I was like, I don't know what that is, but where'd you get it? It's like, yeah. It's like, fucking sign me up. And yeah, I would go to private school and kids would be like, my dad gave me a sip of beer. And I was like, I took a 4-foot bomber up, you know, like I probably wasn't even 4 feet then. You know, with learning about my dad, my brother told me first, and then my dad and I were, I think my dad didn't even smoke with me until I was like 18, maybe older. He knew I was smoking weed. I mean, he would come home and he would, you know, he couldn't pull his Porsche into the garage because there's 100 pounds of weed in the garage. And he's like, oh, Uncle Leroy came over, which was, you know, his friend, my aunt's boyfriend. And I'm like, yeah, Leroy just stopped. He just dropped something off for me. And, you know, that's just was kind of what he let it slide. My mom was gone and my dad was never home. And he just told me, look, you can sell all this weed you want. He's like, but, you know, get that cocaine and get those pills out of my house. Cause I don't want, that's not, that stuff's, people die over that stuff. You don't want to, you want nothing to do with that stuff. So he was always preaching the right stuff. He's a really good guy. I mean, he'll have stories of, I'm trying to think when he actually told me he admitted it. I was in my early 20s, probably, maybe 21, maybe 20, I don't know. But he'll tell stories like, oh, I was in Kathmandu and I had this hashish suit on. I was in this little rickety plane. And like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's so cool. And you just see my friends, like, especially new people to me, and they're like, wow, because he's finally growing his hair back out. Down his hair is probably to right here. He's 70 and growing his hair out because he's got this luscious mane. But yeah, I remember when I got caught for the first time smoking weed at a concert down on the beach. We came home, my mom was like, yell at them, me and my cousin. And my dad looked like, I could see he felt like Judas. He just felt so bad. And he's like, look, man, you guys can't, you know, where'd you get it? And then, you know, my head thinking, I took it from you. But I was like, we bought it at the party. We bought it at the music festival. I never read it, you know, I never said anything. And even today, you know, he talked about what he did in front of the grandkids. He's pretty open about it because he realizes that, you know, it's legal here and it's, you know, it's okay. It's medicine. Just like he's always preached, it's medicine. It's good for people. It's not bad for people. You know, whether you're pregnant or you're a little kid or you're an adult, we're all biologically the same. And just like psychedelics, they're beneficial for everybody.
So turning it to you just touched on, you were smuggling stuff from Mexico over the border. Any close calls for yourself while you were doing that?
No, super easy. You know, 14, 15 year old kid with a bunch of pills taped to his legs, I'd walk, you know, walk across the border. You know, we would get drunk and go to the strip clubs or whatever down there, or just come over during the day. And we just looked like rowdy kids, you know, like they didn't really ever check, didn't find anything at least.
When you started in martial arts then, did you see the benefits of it? Because you said that early on, you'd go around in this gang, you'd all be like beating people up, getting into fights, because, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, martial arts, it improves your confidence, you know, mentally, physically, and then people tend to stop fighting, you know, on the streets, because obviously a lot of times you get into trouble, the gyms will be like, hey, Ian, you can't come here anymore.
Oh, I got kicked out of Jeremy Williams' gym. That's a big regret I had, because I never made peace with my coach, who ended up killing himself. You know, that was rough. And I took it to the point where I wasn't picking on people, but I was beating people up with my friends who were picking on people, sort of thing. You know, I was also robbing drug dealers, you know, other kids that, you know, were, you know, what are they going to do? So we would just take everything from them. It was a very predatorial lifestyle we lived for a while. And I forgot the martial arts way. I did. You know, my first philosophy teacher was Bruce Lee. I read all his books. I listened to all of his stuff, watched his movies. I knew better. I did. But that gang mentality gets to you, you know, as a young, you know, easily influenced person. And I've always knew it, but even during my career, you know, I carried myself as a martial artist, but I was just tortured with the violence, you know, with the trauma that I inflicted upon myself and others kind of as a teenager. My childhood was really good. My parents were awesome. My mom left. But outside of that, you know, like I had tons of trauma from a bunch of friends dying. My, you know, Shane De Rosario died in my arms, my best friend and roommate. Justin Levins killed himself and his wife. Jeremy Williams killed himself. Those are just three MMA people that I was directly attached to very closely. I have another 30 friends that have died from pills and car accidents and murder and suicide and just all this crazy stuff. And then all the fights we got and all the times we hurt people, or I saw my friends get hurt, or I got jumped by skinheads, you know? So there was a lot of head trauma, a lot of craziness in there that drove me to a point of being crazy, like legitimately crazy. And I had this outlet where I could make money off of it. So it was perfect for me.
After the near-death experience, did you look at life like you'd been blessed and given a second chance?
No, not at all. I was sober for a while, you know, until I fought DJ. So, but no, that just went right over my head. Even the death of Shane, you know, it's I felt it then. I was more opened up. I had a kid, but I was addicted with Shane. You know, we were both partying a lot and still trying to fight. So yeah, that those learning experiences they should have been learning experiences, I should say. They weren't. They were just, you know, these really bad things that happened to me. And I let them affect me too much until recently, where I've been able to heal from it.
Was there a turning point? Was there anything like the birth of your daughter or anything that made you change?
Ayahuasca, psychedelics. Psychedelics is, I needed that. I was so stubborn, you know. High dose mushrooms and ayahuasca is what really fixed this Shane situation specifically. You know, I didn't talk to Shane. Just because he's dead doesn't mean he's not around. I can still talk to him, you know. And I didn't do that for years. And finally, grandmother ayahuasca, that's was the first thing she did, was help heal that whole situation. So yeah, I've gone through so many traumatic things in my life, and I just go to ceremony. It's been over a year. I really want to get out to the jungles. Just I have more work to do, you know. I need to reach that higher plane of existence. And you know, I'm sure something will come up during those sits, you know, those ceremonies where I'll go, oh yeah, I forgot about this. I should probably deal with this, you know? So then it comes up and you spend the next year of your life dealing with it, you know?
You touched on all the things that you were taking, cocaine, you know, all the different types of drugs. How were you passing the VADA tests, or would they kind of ban you on the sly? Like they wouldn't give you a fight, but they wouldn't announce that you were essentially banned?
Oh, no. I wasn't popping in the fight. In the fight, I was sober, but I was detoxing. You know, so, but the USADA tests, they didn't at that point, they didn't care if you did drugs. I think it's different now. I think there's some, you're held reliable or held liable for, you know, cocaine or whatever's in there, or certain prescription drugs.
Nick Diaz got 5 years.
Oh, but no, not for cannabis. For, you know, like right now there's something in the literature of for USADA that is where you can't have party drugs in your system when you get tested. Like these athletes have to be clean.
Right. So Ian, going back to your, you know, your pro debut, Jeremy Sampson, August the 3rd, 2002 on Warriors Quest 6. How did that fight come about? Did the coach say to you, hey, do you want to turn pro, or was it your decision?
They wanted to turn me pro when I was 16 on an Indian reservation out here in California. And we thought better of that. I was just too young, too small. I'm sure I could have won, but, you know, this didn't need to happen. So I turned 18 and it was off to the races. I knew this is what I wanted. And Chris Brennan had been looking for fights for me for a while. And they found Jerry, and you know, he was like a multi-time Navy boxing champion, Golden Gloves champ. He could punch really hard, and he's Hawaiian. They can all fight. I think Hawaiians are the toughest people on the planet, also some of the nicest. But they, you know, they lined it up. I went out there and choked him out in the second round, I think. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was the start, you know.
So you don't seem like a nervous guy, but how was, you know, during your career, how was walking to the cage? You know, did you get nervous? What went through your mind?
Oh, it was a drug. It was this amazing drug rush, getting you into a flow state, you know, to inflict, you know, damage on someone, to have this experience where there's no longer a bear chasing me. I'm getting into a cage or a ring and fighting someone. They're trying to kill me. And it was a very wild experience. You know, it would get me so high for so long, you know, just this crazy visceral experience that very few people get to even be around, let alone participate in.
Is that something that now as a coach that you work on, do you help your fighters control their own anger and be able to like function in a high stressful situation?
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, it's getting rid of self or false self narratives and dealing with the trauma, because trauma will embed in your tissue. That's what trauma does, like childhood trauma or whatever you go through. And then it will turn into inflammation, and inflammation turns into things like depression or cancer or Alzheimer's. Depression, you know, there we go. Your neural inflammation is big. And you know, once we can drop those things down through things like microdosing, like my brand Argos, or like you have, you know, your mushrooms and ketamine, which is part of my post-fight concussion protocol. Then you have you know, things like turmeric and CBD and fish oils for the same sort of thing. Those are all natural stuff. You have the breath work and the meditation and yoga, and just the list goes on of these things we can do to program ourselves to perform better, to get rid of the visceral reaction we have to the depression or to the trauma, because that trauma is what's giving us the anxiety. We've been training for this forever. We should be ready to go laser focused. But when you have trauma, or you have the trauma that leads to that anxiety, and I'm not talking about a heightened sense of like, I'm ready to go, a flow state. It gets in the way of your performance. It hurts, actually negatively affects the performance. That's the stuff I'm trying to get rid of. That's the stuff that we're trying to get past. Deal with it, put it in a box and put it behind you. We don't have time for that shit. You know, as performers, as athletes, we are all acting out our childhood traumas on stage. That's just what it is. Those are the driving forces behind us to be great. You know, they push you and they make you, they're the things you think about, you know, like, because this fucking happened to me, I'm going to do this, you know, sort of thing. I'm going to prove, because this happened to me, I'm going to prove that I'm not worthless, whatever that thing makes us feel, I can achieve this. Well, we're there. You're in the UFC. Do you want to be the best in the world? Okay. Because fighting with emotion isn't the best thing to do. Not at this level anymore. No. Everyone is so well trained. Everyone, our bodies are optimized. The UFC puts so much money into human performance. That's why they talk to me. Number one, they know I have nothing but the kids' best interest at heart. All these fighters, I love them all. I want them all I want them all to heal. You know, what made you be a fighter in the first place? What sort of trauma did you go through? And now your job is to get in your underwear, climb into a cage and fight people for blood money, giving and receiving PTSD the whole time in front of a giant crowd. You know, that's a lot. So if I can help unpack all that stuff, do the post-fight concussion protocol, make them better people, then it's something I call the pollination effect. I was taught this by another researcher named Melissa Dawn. She goes, I'm the queen bee, Ian, you're the worker bee. Now with your blue check mark, go out and pollinate all those lines with the right information. As you pollinate them, they put the spotlight on you. Do not keep the spotlight. Turn the spotlight back on the healing, on the right stuff, on the actual science, on the researchers, the people that are doing the right information. Now I have all the right information. I'm the queen bee. I'm trying to build teams of athletes to do this exact thing. Heal themselves with the tools that we provide, we can help you with. You know, ketamine's legal. Ketamine's an amazing legal tool. Having to talk to a doctor. Let's say we're trying to keep this legal. Ketamine, doctor, prescription. Then I talk to athletes like this over telemedicine. Say, okay, how do you feel? Let's talk about things. Because eventually I want them to use their blue check mark, their influence, to influence all their people and tell them this is my story. And even if, let's say you have Will Smith on one side and you have Aaron Rodgers. Have you heard of these two guys?
Do I know who they are?
Yeah. You have an accent. I don't know. I'm sure Will Smith, you know. Aaron Rodgers, you know, he used ayahuasca, and they asked him, they said, what gave you the two best performances, you know, career-wise in your life? It was ayahuasca. What do you attribute it to? Ayahuasca. Now, I know who he sits with because these are people I've worked with. Aubrey Marcus, Kyle Kingsbury, the Fit for Service program. I know how good these people. They're some of the best in the Western world at doing this. They are. And he sat with the right people, I'm sure with the real shamans, not some yoga teacher who's like light and love and energy. No. Like really did it the right way. And then went to those people about light, love, and energy, and then figured out how to integrate this whole thing into life. So he became better. Let's go over to Will Smith. Will Smith did an inappropriate amount of ayahuasca, like 14 times in a year. You know, he didn't integrate properly. He goes back into a horrible relationship with a woman. Obviously, ayahuasca made her ego much bigger, you know, where he's cracked open trying to figure himself out. He's being abused on TV, having to talk about his problems. And then he acts out and goes and slaps someone on national TV. This is not integrating properly. But at least we have to have that example. Because no matter what, people are going to love Will Smith. He's a really good person, you know, at his heart of hearts, he's a really good person, but he's a human and we all got human shit, just a broken child, and he didn't use the medicine properly. So we need the two examples because Will can always get better. I'm pretty sure he's going through the process now. I'm sure he'll come out on the other side and be such a good example, you know, because we need that. We need to show that path. I did the same thing. I didn't integrate properly. That's why I do what I do. Because I was like, oh, this is coming down the pipe for a bunch of athletes. And no one works specifically with athletes with athlete problems. I was like, okay, I need to get in front of this because we're going to elevate sports to a new level. We're going to elevate people who should be looked at as heroes to a new level. Look at Conor McGregor and Jon Jones, two of the best fighter of all time and the most prolific fighter of all time. They're looked at as villains, you know, as douchebags. Because they do a lot of douchey shit. Maybe, you know, they party way too much, you know, not like with a good kind of party. They're out drinking and doing blow and acting like guys who do that sort of shit. And it's not good. These people should be examples of how to live your life. You're a martial artist. Act like one. Don't act like a dick, you know? And I'll be the first to say Conor was really nice to me. John was very nice to me. But I would say this to their face. Like, even though, you know, John and I don't really get along, besides the point, that's our issue. Who cares? You got to be better. You have to be better for this world because people look up to you, you know, and with how fucked up the world is, we need role models. We need strong, strong male role models. You know, we do, because we've lost so much of that in society.
After what you said about, you know, getting the fighters to look at stuff and then kind of put it in a box and then, you know, work on it. Like, what exactly is it you do? You think about it, you break down those scenarios. Like, how do you get somebody to work past these events?
I mean, there's Western psychology techniques like EMDR, you know, guided meditations, things like that. And you access them through my method, through psychedelics. You know, you get cracked open, whether it's big or small. Small dose is kind of while you're going through the therapy. Because when you're on a big dose, no one should be talking to you. You should be on your yoga mat by yourself going through it. The microdose will kind of, especially when this is already open from this, from the ayahuasca or the mushrooms, whatever it is, your brain will be settled. Your default mode network drops. The thing that protects you from all those traumas. Think of your brain as a circle, the default mode network where all your hungry ghosts, all the traumas are inside. And we can't get through those walls very well with things like EMDR. EMDR is good at it, but you've got no mechanism like psychedelics to drop the fear response, get into those things and disassociate a bit, you know, be high, be to have that high feeling. And you're at peace and you go, wow, this is what happened. Then you're able to recollect it in a better way because your body lets you remember, your mind lets you remember, and you're able to pick it apart and go, okay, this was my fault. This was uncontrollable. This was their fault, and not have the visceral reaction to it anymore, and also learn some forgiveness. Learn to forgive them, learn to forgive you, you know, and learn to forgive the situation because things happen. And then you can not have that same reaction, like I was saying. You know, you have people talk about neural pathways from the brain to the end. There's a trauma at the end of that pathway. And the pathway itself is your reaction. It's like this, you know, if it's not smooth, you and you have those things come up and you're like, whoa, they make you feel just gross and angry or sad, whatever it is. And you get caught in these loops and you're in this loop and maybe you have multiple loops spinning at a time, you know, and your poor people, your wife or your friends or whoever, some guy driving by, they get caught in those loops with you and they get spit out, but they just deal like, you know, this is like, so you're constantly having to fight this stuff. If you can change the reaction to those things, then the loop goes away. Well, change the reaction, then you deal with it, then it goes away, you know, but you have to change that response your body has to it, because then you can analyze it. Your brain's not going to function properly if you're in the fight or flight mode where you're just trying to run from it, just trying to pack it in there more, you know.
Looking at your UFC career, like you touched on, you signed for the UFC December 2011 to compete in a four-man flyweight tournament to determine the inaugural UFC flyweight champion.
Yeah.
Probably, what you say, two of the biggest fights that you had in your career against Demetrius Johnson. I believe you said in other interviews, going into the first fight, you actually had to cut a dangerous amount of weight before the fight.
The second one, I let my whole life go awry. And I cut 18.8 pounds in the last 20 hours. My hearing went, my sight went, like I had to have Jason House, my agent, hold me up. I couldn't look at, couldn't even see my phone. And that was, I thought I was going to die.
How did you do it, Ian? Was that saunas?
Yeah, sauna. I think we did sauna bath and sauna suit. It was horrible. Well, I end up taking, instead of like one IV bag, which would have been appropriate, I took three. By the time 12 midnight came, the you know, later that day on weigh-ins, you know, weigh-ins was like three at that point. By the time it was midnight, I was 152.2 pounds. Yeah, so I had a six pack, but I had love handles. My body was bloated, my joints hurt, I was slow. Yeah, that was not a good look for me. It was a really bad idea. And, you know, my relationship was, you know, gone to shit. It was already gone to shit, but this was even worse. You know, we were both addicted. We were both being crazy. You know, it was not good.
Do you look back on those fights and do you regret what happened?
Of course. Things would be a lot different, but I don't hold on to them anymore. I just go, okay, it's led me here and I love my life. My life's incredible. I'm retired. I now live a life of service where everything I do isn't for money. It is to help people my whole entire life. Sure, I've got, you know, a lot of cool job type stuff with big companies and I get to work with world-class athletes, Olympians or whatever. But it's all for other people because that's what makes me happiest. You know, I have my daughter. She's like my girlfriend. You know, she gets all my free time. She has a family life with her mom, little brother and sister, stepdad, and goes to school there. I'm not good at that sort of stuff. So I get her on the weekends and then, you know, she gets all that time. She goes to the UFC with me. She travels internationally with me. I'll take her to Tulum or wherever I'm going. But, you know, outside of her, my whole life is service. You know, it's the way I approach all my business ventures, all the things that I do.
After the UFC, like you touched on before, you signed with Rizin. It sounds like you really enjoyed your time over there. You learned a lot.
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of fun. I made some really good friends. My buddy Eric lives out there. So I can go stay, you know, in Tokyo anytime I want. And I get to stay in, you know, Ebisu, which is like the nicest part of town. And he shows me around. And it's an amazing culture. I wish I could go back to announce for Rizin, maybe teach a seminar or something. But I need a vacation out of it. You know, this time, that's what I've been doing. I've been revisiting places and just going like, okay, I have to go back here because I have to spend a week just doing touristy stuff, you know, going on the bullet train, going here, going there. And I love travel. I've learned back to me, the fact I didn't pay attention in school, I couldn't pay attention. I've learned more from my travels than probably just about anything.
Your last fight was May the 6th, 2018 against, Kauji Horiguchi, which finished quickly in round one. Did you know going into the fight that there may be a chance that you would retire if you lost?
Yeah, I thought about it. Mm-hmm.
And how easy was it to accept it that the journey was over?
It wasn't that hard, to be honest, but it was really hard to go through. I had a buddy of mine who, you know, he's a bronze medalist in the Olympics. He's rad. Pulls me aside and he goes, "Hey, man, I heard you're retiring. We need to talk." And he broke down everything that was going to happen. It's going to be really hard and you're going to go through all these steps and then you're going to come out the other end as a coach, as a teacher, an educator. And your life is going to be much more fulfilled. You're going to be much happier. You're going to make more money. You're going to do a lot of this stuff, just like me, man. He's like, he told me that 5 years ago, whatever it was, and it's come true, all of it. I've had a handful of people say things or do things like that in my life, where I'm like, I look back, I'm like, they were 100% right. It's crazy.
After retirement, was it hard not to fall back into your old ways?
Oh, you mean addiction?
Yeah.
No, because I made sure it was bulletproof. Psychedelics showed me I had to get sober, and the way I had to get sober was I had to retire. And I was on the verge of killing myself, you know, for years. I was on the verge of killing myself. And I had my daughter, and I knew I couldn't do that. And I wanted to change. I wanted it to be over. I wasn't happy anymore. I wasn't happy for a long time. And I went through a peptide regimen, injected myself every day for a while, and using, you know, BPC-157, NAD plus, and some other stuff where, you know, it sucks. I could barely lift my arms up. I was in so much pain, but I didn't have any withdrawal symptoms. I healed my body because I was also microdosing. And when you microdose, you're trying to create the same sort of chemicals in your brain. And I was had a healing of all that stuff, got me off the drugs. And I was like, we're done. I'm out. No more of this. And if I wanted to take something, I had psychedelics, you know, as an addict. I was like, yeah, I have that option. You know, I microdose all the time. So it wasn't like, you know, I don't think abstinence is the key for some people. You know, that just doesn't work. And when you get caught in like an AA system where, I don't know if you've ever been to AA, but it's really depressing. And I don't like it. Everyone's so negative and just, ugh. I was like, I'm way too happy of a person to be here. And psychedelics made me happy. I understood the science of it and I understood the healing potentials. So I knew through medicine, plant medicine, I was getting better, not worse.
And how was it for you to spend time in, you know, places like rehab? And I think you mentioned you went to jail when you're Ian McCall, you know, people have seen you on TV.
Well, it didn't feel good. Didn't feel good at all. No.
When you went to jail, did you have to share a cell with anybody? Was it like a dormitory?
A dormitory. I always had a bunkmate. Yeah. I met some cool people in there. You know, they're just people who fucked up, you know, people that are caught in the system. And sure, some of them are, you can tell, are just weird kind of, you know, monsters, but there's a lot of honest, decent people in there.
Looking back on your career, what was your favorite fight?
DJ won, and the second one would be Brad Pickett, because I was out in Ireland and I did put on a really good performance.
Is there anybody that you would have liked to have fought in your career?
Let me think here. Neil Seary, because we almost fought a couple times. We never got to, but I think I would smoke him back then, you know. But that was just a guy I liked, a person I liked that I felt like I owed him because we had a couple fights fall through. But from a technical aspect, I'm trying to think who's the best guy that I didn't get to fight. Oh, Dotson. That's a fight, fun fight, because he was dangerous. Who else? Oh, Triple C. I was sitting with him. I was sitting with him and Mike Tyson not that long ago, a year ago maybe. And I guess a little over a year ago now that I think about it. Wasn't that long ago. And he's like, you know what, man? I'm really happy we didn't fight when we were supposed to fight. Because I popped my knee, sprained it real bad, and we didn't get to fight. And he's like, this was before his transformation. And he's like, you would have whooped my ass. And I was like, I know. maybe not so much now. But he's someone I really enjoy. People know because he's cringy and he's silly. But it's all an act. It's like Chael Sonnen. They're really good people. Mm. Like Henry's a really, really good, nice dude. And especially now that I know that about him, his whole thing is hilarious to me. It's so stupid. But he even asked me, he goes, hey, bro, what do you think? And I was like, of what? He goes, of my whole like cringe thing. And I was like, oh, you're asking the wrong guy. I was like, well, my nickname is Uncle Creepy. Who gives a fuck what I think? Like, are you getting the right response out of people? Yeah. I'm like, okay, you win. You're the goddamn triple champ, bro. Do whatever you want. Like, it's, and you're good at it. You know, it's not like you're babbling, blah, blah, blah. It sounds stupid. You do it well. So keep going. Hats off to you, man.
Right. As long as it sells, right?
And it does, you know, as silly or stupid or whatever negative thing people want to think about it, you're watching it. You know, you're watching it and you're getting this response, and that's what he wants. He wins. If people don't understand that, then, you know, then that's their fault.
Ian, who's the most talented fighter that didn't make it? Whether they just didn't want to turn pro or whether they kind of like wilted under the lights?
Man. There's so many of them. There's people that people don't even know, like don't have pro fight sort of guys that are so good. Trying to think who would be, man, I don't want to say myself because I'll sound like a douchebag. I'm just trying to think of who is a good example. I don't know. So who do you think? Maybe that'll spark my interest a little more. While I try and go through the Rolodex of people.
That's a good question. You turned it around on me.
You know, I think to the people in the gym. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of gym heroes.
Yeah.
That are so good, and people will never know their names because they don't make it outside of amateurs, or they go pro, or they're like 0-2 as a pro, and you never know who they are. And these guys will whoop your ass. I remember even when I was the best in the world, and there's this one guy out here, Alp, and Olazink, and I think he fought in the UFC. Yeah, he fought in the UFC. And my coach called me on like a Sunday, I think it was. He's like, hey, you need to get in the gym. And I was like, I was in Vegas. I'm like, no, I don't. I'm like, I'm still high on ecstasy. Like, I'm not leaving the strip club. Sorry. He's like, get in the fucking gym now. So I went to the gym and got my ass beat by some nobody. Sure, he went on to do a little bit, but like not that much, you know. And he spars with my boxer now, my bare knuckle boxer, Mark Irwin. And he, you know, has this wild style, weird wrestler style, but like that just shows you on any given day, some of these guys can be so good and just beat your ass. And you know, so I would give it to all the people that the no names out there, because there's a lot of them, man.
Mm. That's why I like to ask that question, because some people straight away they'll name somebody at the gym and they just didn't want to turn pro, or they just, you know, they can't handle the lights and they kind of just wilt under the pressure. But they're kind of, you know, like a gym fighter, like the standard kind of gym fighter.
Jeremy Williams, my old coach, who took his own life. Mm. That guy was so talented back then. And had some good performances, but never really got to show his true potential, because, man, he was really good. And he's the same guy that literally hurt me in the gym on purpose and then kicked me out of his gym because I was doing dumb shit as a little gangbanging idiot.
This question might not kind of relate to you because you have lived a glitz and glamour life, but what would you say is the biggest misconception for your life as an MMA fighter?
I've heard it from a few different women. Oh, you guys all hit women. I'm like, no. But we're thinking of boxers. Boxers, because boxers don't have any education. It's a poor person sport, you know? And I'm not excusing them because of their lack of education, but that environment you grew up in, you know, it happens a lot. It's what you're raised around. And I'm not saying that all boxers hit women, but because MMA, yeah, some guys do too. I hear it often, not often, but I hear it sometimes. So that's the biggest misconception, I think, that's sticking to my head right now. Yeah, I would say that, or maybe that we're stupid. Because again, boxers, uneducated, not the smartest people in the world usually. Some of them, there's, you know, are very, but the overall person, that the average person in UFC is smart. An education, an actual college education, and you know, philosophical, like when you sit down with fighters and you hear them talk, it's different. It's different than the average person. It really is.
Since retiring, how many offers have you had to come back, and did the bare knuckle companies reach out to you?
Yeah, they offered me $30,000 and I was like, oh shit, my star has fallen. I'm not that cool anymore. 30 grand, get the fuck out of here. And I'm not a fighter anymore. I got offered a fight with Floyd Mayweather for this last Burj Khalifa one where he fought in Dubai. And I said, yeah, Frank Shamrock, my old agent, called me. He goes, hey, man, I got a deal for you. Would you fight Floyd for, you know, $2 million? And I was like, of course. Yeah, I'll come off the yoga mat and I'll fight Floyd. And they lined it up. And obviously I wasn't the only person because they got someone for way cheaper. But that, you know, I think we settled on like $2.5 million or something like that. And I started to get ready. I went out there and I trained my ass off. I was at Ruka with Chito Vera and Jason Perillo and Mackenzie Dern. And I'm always in shape. I wasn't going to have to cut much weight. You know, like I'm always in shape, but I started to get a feel that my body was hurting by the end of the week. And like Friday I was moving around with Chito and then we kind of light sparring, you know, headgear on, just playing, you know, more or less, and drilling heavy. Well, I got a little bit too much ego. I was like, I got this. I'm still bigger and faster and stronger. I'm more athletic. Like I still have this thing where I'm still in a league above most of these people. Cause Chito is not the most athletic person. When he first got to America, he sucked. He was not strong. He wasn't good at anything. He would still kick me in the face every once in a while. And I would get so frustrated. Cause I'm like, how is this guy even touching me? He's gotten so good. It's crazy. Fourth round, Saturday, we start sparring. Fourth round, he's playing with me, you know, I'm sure most of the time. And all of a sudden, bang, I ran into a heavy uppercut because I'm trying to learn, you know, I'm in fight mode. I'm trying to fuck him up. My knees buckled, bounced back up. And he's like, oh shit, I'm sorry. You okay? Like, I don't want to be here anymore. Fuck it, this is stupid. And Perillo pulls me out. You know, even we went and ran sprints after, and I can sprint faster than all these people. but I realized I'm not a fighter anymore. Luckily, after that week, they stopped talking to me. They found someone for cheaper because I couldn't walk for like those sprints. I hadn't sprinted in, I don't know how, years. And I felt like I almost tore my hamstrings. Like I have to run faster than everybody. That's what I do. I'm just that guy. And dude, it hurt so bad where I couldn't even walk the next 2 weeks. And they never contacted me again. So I was like, okay, that was a close call. I guess I don't need $2 million extra in my bank. I mean, I don't want to get that out of here. And then when I saw Floyd fight, when he beat the shit out of that dude, he was aggressive. And I was like, oh, that would have sucked so bad. That would have been so scary. I wanted to do a live brain study on myself, test my brain before, test my brain after, you know, get analytics because I'm a researcher. But, you know, it just, I'm happy it didn't happen because, yeah.
Did they throw any names at you for the bare knuckle? And did you even consider it?
No, I said, fuck you. I said, how dare you call me with that? You know, because he goes, big money, bare knuckle. And I go, dude, don't call me ever again. An hour later, I was like, okay, what's big money? And he said, 30 grand. And I was like, I'm out. You know, Mark asked me if I would fight. He goes, what if they gave you like a cool $500,000? Would you do it? I was like, I don't know. Yeah, but it depends on who. I don't want to fight anymore. I don't care. But maybe if I could really put something together. But I most likely I doubt it. You know, I wouldn't want to.
So, Ian, thanks to you, the UFC is actually considering studying psychedelics now. Can you just give us all a quick dummy's guide to psychedelics and microdosing?
This is my company, Argos. If you want to order it, you can order it online. It's just in the US. So microdosing and psychedelics in general cause something called epigenetic neurogenesis. It is the production of chemicals in your brain that lead to healing. They've always told us growing up, once you kill brain cells, they're dead forever. It's not true. You can heal your brain. You can heal your receptors. You can heal the neural pathways and all of the hemispheres of the brain. Because they usually work in like four separate parts. Your brain usually works that way. But now everything's interconnected. It's working as one. I guess there's two hemispheres and then there's the four parts. But everything syncs up and you can not only heal the brain, but protect from further trauma. With like a, you know, anti-inflammation effect and a protective value. And then you have all your senses get heightened because you're in a flow state. You know, you can smell better and hear better and taste better. And the flow state leads you to perform better. You have better body, you know, body mechanics. Your kinetic efficiency is much better. Your breath is better. That fear response, again, being dropped. You're not worried about breathing. You're not worried about going for moves. Everything kind of slows down. So you have this hyper-awareness, which is the flow state. And it just makes people better people. You're not gonna attach onto the PTSD that's going to happen when you're in this fight.
So Ian, I know that you work with people on this. So say I decide to buy it from the internet, from your store, I decide to buy it. How do I know how much to take?
It says on the tin. So a microdose is what we make, and it is sub-perceptual. You're not supposed to feel it. That's how this works. People always say, oh, I took your product, I didn't feel anything. I'm like, you're not supposed to feel it. That's how this is supposed to happen. Because people want to get high. People like altered states of reality, some of them. Some of them like soccer moms or kids in school who don't want to take Adderall, or little autistic children, or brain surgeons who don't want to fuck up your brain surgery. They don't want to be high, but they want that heightened state. They want that mood elevation. They want to be in the zone when they do what they have to do. And that's what microdosing does. It heals the brain and makes you that much more efficient, that much better, that much happier. It's a panacea. And that word, you know, has a negative connotation, like it's fake, but no, it's a panacea because it the way it works with the body. Our bodies go through traumas, the trauma embeds in our tissue, the trauma turns into inflammation, and that wreaks havoc in our body through things like depression or, you know, anxiety or the cancers or what have you. If you can knock down the inflammation, that stuff goes away. So think of how many things in that space get dealt with.
And the UFC is now open to studying this and working with you?
Yeah, I first set them up a couple of years ago with Johns Hopkins University. And that one, you know, Johns Hopkins is the biggest in the industry. They couldn't come to terms. So now I'm trying to go with the University of Miami. They want to try and make it happen. And, you know, I'm trying to get them interested in ketamine therapy. I'm trying to get them interested in a lot of stuff because I know how beneficial it is, and I know it'll help the athletes. And this won't just be for athletes. Eventually, it'll go to the executives. It'll go to the people that work for the company. You know, it'll go to people that clean toilets or ring girls or whoever it is. Everybody deserves these therapies.
Just describe to us the the jungle trips that you do for the ayahuasca. I think I've listened to Joe Rogan, and he's kind of touched on these before.
So you go, you know, you go to Mexico or Peru, and you go into the jungles, or you can go to a retreat center. There's some that are more westernized for, you know, people that don't want to do a jungle trip. I myself, like my next one, hopefully will be in the winter, is me going with a river rafting guide deep into the jungle, going through class five rapids to get to the retreat center, spending a week in the jungle, and then river rafting back out. My guide, my rafting guide, is in the medicine space too. And she's like, this is what I'm going to do this year. And I was like, well, I'm in. That sounds incredible. It is something that I yearn for. I miss the jungles a lot. Once you've been there, once you've reached those states, you sit with these little people that don't speak your language. They don't speak a language you've ever heard. And they're just like little jungle creatures, these little people that are just so full of wisdom. And you learn things about yourself and the world and the vibrations and Mother Nature and, you know, the constructs of life, the things you were taught, the things you were programmed with. You know, we have to break all of that so we can become better, because this world's in a pretty bad state. It is. And if we can change that, it has to start here. One by one, we all have to heal first. Then we can get there.
So whilst you're down there, you take, is the ayahuasca, is that like a mushroom or?
No, it's a drink.
Oh, it's a drink. So you take the drink and then you kind of opens up kind of like your third eye and you see the world in a different way. Is that?
Well, you can have full out of body experiences where, you know, people come to you, the grandmother ayahuasca will come to you as an old woman, a little kid. She came to me as a beautiful woman. She brought me my best friend who was dead, and we had to deal, talk things out. You go through these sort of experiences. You do relive things, but your body is now in a safe place and being held by the medicine to where you can actually deal with it instead of, you know, being traumatized by it.
Well, Ian, one question that I always like to finish on, what would you tell somebody that wants to follow in your footsteps?
Go to my website, themccallmethod.com, or email me at ian@themccallmethod, or go on my social media, Ian McCall, or there's, again, The McCall Method. It's on Instagram and on TikTok. Or read more, you know, read some articles, look up some more podcasts I'm on if you want more information. Or contact me and we can talk, you know, we can go over some stuff. I've got clients from people that, a lot of very high level athletes, that's the main people I work with, but I have normal people too, males, females, young, old, people that, you know, are going through addiction, to people that are successful. This is for everybody. So you'll never be excluded. Obviously we have to look at like in medications and stuff you're on, but this isn't you're not just going to do a drug. This is going to clean up your whole life. Ayahuasca, specifically ayahuasca, will forever change the fabric of your reality. So this goes with diet and exercise and breath work and meditation. You know, there's a lot of things that we can add in there, and it all helps. It all makes life a lot better, because we need to start taking care of ourselves and each other.
Well, Ian, I'd like to thank you for giving me about 90 minutes of your day. If you want to tell everybody, you know, where they can find you, your website, your gym, any sponsors, anything that you've got going on.
Obviously Argos, RGMN.com, Argos Regimen. Go check this out. If you're in America, you can order some microdoses or some of these cool clothes. The McCallMethod.com, my social media, Ian McCall, go look at it all. And just take time to do your research. You know, I'm not the only person out there. There's a lot of us. I shouldn't say that. There's not a lot of us. There's a good amount of us now that are helping, that are doing it the right way. And there's different flavors for different folks. So see what resonates with you. And even if you're looking for someone else, if you're a female that wants a male, I can, a female that wants a female coach, I can lead you in that direction. You know, we're a very open community, and we just want people to do better. That's all. So thank you for even thinking about it, and hopefully the medicine's in your life and working in that direction, and we get to chat someday.
Your social media handles, do you want to give those out?
Yeah, Ian McCall and the McCall Method.
And we are at TLR MMA on Instagram and Twitter. And be sure to catch us next time. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Last Round MMA Podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow The Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLRMMA.